Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 144. It's Monday, December 27th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, I wanted to start today's show with some updates on Omicron, trying to better understand what's going on right now. I want to do three little case studies. First, on understanding Omicron severity. Seems to be a lot of confusion around that. Also, what's up with this new Pfizer COVID-19 antiviral pill, and what will it mean? And lastly, what about this 500 million test kits the federal government is promising? Okay, first up, understanding Omicron severity. Well, there's a lot of confusion because people seem to talk about it in their reporting about the virus's characteristics versus the fact that it'll have an epidemic on the entire population. So this is, you know, the difference between kind of medical science versus public health science, individual versus populations. So if we had a perfect experiment, we could compare the previous variants to people that are both unvaccinated, had infection but no vaccination, people that were vaccinated fully, people that were vaccinated fully and boosted, people that had the virus and then were vaccinated. So you have a lot of different possibilities of combinations. And the thing is, that's all mixed up in the population. Of course, that's changed over time. So if we had Omicron a year ago, before we had widespread vaccinations, you know, that would be a fair comparison to like how it ripped through. But of course, the bottom line, the word on the street, when the rubber hits the road, is what happens when a virus hits a particular population with a particular level of population immunity. So from a scientific point of view, It is very difficult to analyze these numbers of like severe disease, hospitalizations, generally how they measure that. Death obviously is going to follow, but Omicron's too new to have a big wave of death to really get good data on that. So looking at hospitalization as a proxy for severe disease, you have to look at that. How does the Omicron variant compare with, say, Delta or previous variants as far as on a per case basis? You get 100 cases in unvaccinated, how many of those are going to end up in the hospital? That doesn't seem to be much different. I mean, maybe holding out for like a 10 or 20% difference, but it's probably not much. Now, of course, like I said, we have a whole bunch more immunity. So, and the big difference between Omicron and even Delta is that it breaks into the vaccinated population very well. And as we'll see in some reporting I'll do in a little bit, we can fully expect that most of the infections that happen with Omicron will be among vaccinated people. But of course, the severity will be a lot less. So, of course, population-wise, the severity is going to be based on the number of cases you have times the case fatality rate. The case fatality rate just being the chance you have of dying, of any individual dying of it. Now, the thing is, this is difficult because you have huge numbers times small numbers. And with Omicron, the numbers of cases is going to be huge. There's no question this is going to be unprecedented, the number of infections that happen. But of course, there's way more population immunity protection from severe disease in the population than there has been in earlier waves. So when you factor that all in, yeah, we're going to see a lot more deaths. The question is how much. That still has yet to be seen. Okay, well, and of course, the severity is not simply just hospitalizations or deaths, but you have a whole, iceberg or pyramid of things that happen. And one of those that people have been keeping track of is like long COVID. Even people that get mild cases still have incidences of long COVID. Now, this is definitely less in people that are vaccinated, probably even less so in people that are boosted. But when you're talking about tens of millions of people getting infected, even very low rates of these problems can create huge numbers of people with substantial health problems. And there was one estimated floating out that they're looking at maybe 140 million infections in this Omicron wave. That's almost half of the U.S. population. And of course, most of those people would actually have some previous immunity through either previous infection or vaccination or even a booster. Okay, well, next up, Pfizer COVID-19 antiviral pill. This, in its clinical trials, that was among unvaccinated people at high risk, it had a very large drop in severity. So that is great news. We have a couple issues here. First of all, the clinical trials population, which is unvaccinated, and those people that are at high risk, you know, with underlying conditions, that type of thing, immune compromising situations, all that kind of stuff, that's who the drug is intended for. But I would guess in the real world, frankly, that the way it's given does not completely follow that. For instance, are physicians going to give this to vaccinated people that are potentially at high risk, say people in nursing homes, but are fully vaccinated or maybe even boosted? There's a question. So the thing is, it may actually be cost effective to do that. But if you have a very limited supply, and I'll get to that in a minute, if you have a very limited supply, the question is how effective, what's the most you can do with what you've got? And if you've got a very limited supply, you should give to the people the highest risk where you can get the most benefit from. And that, of course, would be among the unvaccinated. Okay, the other problem is just simply how to administer this. Having a pill on a shelf is very different than having it in a person who it's going to do the most good. So the pills have to be taken as soon as possible once symptoms appear. That means within 3 to 5 days of symptoms. The challenge is that you have to get tested, you have to get a prescription, and you have to start the pills in this short window. Now, of course, with testing being very limited, and the fact that when you want to enter the healthcare system, you may actually have to get tested twice. You may have to do a home test, and if that shows a positive, your physician may very well want to do a confirmatory PCR test. Now, we know that getting home tests is not that easy. You can get the results quickly, but if you get a PCR test, if they're jammed up, you might have to wait 2 days, 3 days. So by the time you get that, you may be well over 5 days into your symptoms before a physician feels comfortable even giving a prescription with a confirmed infection. So that's a problem. And of course, that very fact that that's very difficult is probably going to favor the wealthy, the better resourced folks getting it, which may or may not be the best people to get it to. Okay, so what they have available basically now is 65,000 courses of this drug. You have to take like 3 pills twice a day for like 5 days. So they have 65,000 of these courses. That seems like quite a bit. And they're promising 200,000 courses by the end of January. But you have to remember, we could be hitting 1 million identified infections a day in January. So, at best, the 65,000 courses is maybe a day's worth of treatment in January. So, you're talking about, say, you can use it in 3% of the cases. So, if it's used effectively, you might see a decrease in the ultimate mortality of this wave by a few percent. And that's if it's used effectively, which I'm not confident that it'll be used that well because, as I've reported before, there's huge variations and biases that get introduced when you've got something, first of all, that's in high demand, people that are wealthy and better resourced and high status tend to get stuff, even though they may not be the highest risk people to give it to. Okay, well, basic prediction on these antiviral pills, and there's another one by Merck that doesn't work very well, that there's a bit bigger supply of, which probably creates a bigger mess. But my basic prediction is that this Pfizer antiviral pill, the one that works much more effectively, will be of very limited use during the Omicron tidal wave, but it will be of great use later in the pandemic, because we're going to have millions of these pills, you know, by the end of the year. So in the long term, it'll be of great use, but like the story has been so often, it might be too little, too late, as far as dealing with this Omicron tidal wave of infections. Okay, third thing up is, what about this 500 million test kits that the federal government is promising? Well, 500 million, again, sounds like a lot, but that's about 1.5 tests per American. But, you know, it's a great press release, but the reality on the ground is they have no contractor in order to work. They don't even know what tests they're going to have. They have no website. They're declaring that it'll only be available online by request and get it mail order. So you have to make the request and obviously get it shipped to you. Now, they're promising the availability by the end of January. Does that mean the website's up? Does that mean people get it by January? Again, this is probably a real example of too little, too late, and I would argue not a very good way to distribute. It'd be much better, I think, to ship large numbers of cases to, or even smaller, medium amounts to a wider variety, you know, just send them to the states or to different community groups, that kind of thing, that can distribute them, is more likely to get where they can really do the most good. But of course, 500 million test kits is not that many when you're talking about so many Americans in such a big wave. Okay, well, let's get to some more COVID-19 news. This is from Medical Express. Testing only the unvaccinated may do little to stop or curb the spread of Omicron with its ability to infect the vaccinated. When no one is vaccinated, of course, infections are going to be 100% unvaccinated. Likewise, when everyone is vaccinated, any infections that do occur are going to be 100% breakthroughs. So somewhere in between, there's got to be a vaccination rate where infections are half breakthroughs and half among the unvaccinated. We wanted to understand this point. Modeling a vaccine with the effectiveness of two mRNA doses and with about a third of people with partial immunity from prior infection, this 50-50 tipping point occurred when 68% of individuals were vaccinated, which is close to what we have right now in the states. Many U.S. states, including Colorado, are nearing or have exceeded that threshold, a threshold expected to be lower for the Omicron variant. We all see news stories that talk about vaccine breakthrough infections as if they are an unexpected phenomenon, but our analysis changes expectations. We shouldn't be surprised by breakthroughs when most individuals are vaccinated. Notably, this study was completed before the Omicron variant swept the world. Since vaccines are less effective at preventing Omicron infections, the authors note that the tipping points for both infection and transmission will now occur at even lower vaccination rates. The takeaway now? People should not be surprised to hear about more breakthrough infections, but should also remember that the vaccines also protect against severe disease and hospitalizations. So, given this, even with the Delta variant before, we had reached the point where we would really expect that the majority of infections would actually be among vaccinated people. With Omicron, we could make that, we could very well have twice as many infections among vaccinated people as unvaccinated. And as I was saying before, there's a huge difference in how that plays out in the severity, but when you're talking sheer number of infections, it's going to be very common among vaccinated folks. And the coronavirus will keep making the rounds.
Hi, I'm Corey the coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, next up I have a story from MarketWatch, and this gets to the point that, you know, a lot of folks that are persistently unvaccinated and even proud of it often talk about being, you know, fearless and all this type of thing. But this story gets at the way that COVID-19 vaccination actually reduces anxiety and depression symptoms. And that is actually among the vaccinated, not the unvaccinated. So this from MarketWatch. COVID-19 vaccination reduces anxiety and depression symptoms by nearly 30%, researchers say. Vaccination against COVID-19 helps protect millions of people from the coronavirus while reducing their risk of serious illness from the disease. But new research says it may also help alleviate the scourge of anxiety and depression. While vaccines are primarily aimed at reducing COVID-19 transmission and mortality risks, they may have important secondary benefits, according to a new paper from the University of Southern California and the RAND Corporation. We estimate that COVID-19 vaccination reduces anxiety and depression symptoms by nearly 30%, they concluded. Fear of testing positive among frontline workers and social isolation has taken an emotional toll on millions of people. The researchers noted larger reductions in anxiety or depression symptoms among individuals with lower education levels, who rent their homes, who are not able to work remotely, and who have children in their household. Nearly all the benefits are private benefits, and we find little evidence of spillover effects. That is, increases in community vaccination rates are not associated with improved anxiety or depression symptoms among the unvaccinated, they added. Nearly one-third of U.S. adults reported experiencing symptoms of anxiety or depression in a survey of almost 51,000 U.S. adults by the U.S. Census Bureau and the National Center for Health Statistics in September and October. So I'd be curious to know, are the people that are experiencing anxiety as unvaccinated, would they have less anxiety if they got vaccinated? That would be an interesting experiment. Let's see that happen. Okay, well, let's get back to some basics. I want to do a couple stories that really get back to basic prevention of COVID-19. This from Medical Express. Impacts of rainy weather on coronavirus outbreaks reveal economic benefits from earlier social distancing. What can a few rainy days teach us about the economics of combating the coronavirus pandemic? Quite a lot, as it turns out. The weekend before the first wave of stay-at-home orders were issued, rainy weather prompted behavior similar to early social distancing in some counties across the U.S., and health data indicate that these behavior changes likely saved lives. Economists at UC Santa Cruz have studied the effect of the stroke of luck as part of a natural experiment. Their findings show how communities that started some form of social distancing slightly earlier may have experienced significant economic benefits. The new research published in the Journal of Health Economics suggests that a 1% decrease in the population leaving home due to rain on the weekend before lockdown likely slowed spread of the virus enough to create an average of up to $132 of benefit per county resident within 2 weeks, resulting from avoided COVID-19 deaths. Based on these findings and the results of prior studies, the paper's author estimate that starting initial pandemic lockdowns 2 days earlier would have generated as much as $198 to $264 of benefit per person within 2 weeks, compared to an estimated cost of $2 to $14 per person in additional lost wages. When it comes to implementing lockdowns, I think this shows that having faster decision-making processes really pays off compared to a more wait-and-see approach, said Associate Professor of Economics A.J. Chenoy, lead author of the new paper. While the public health basis for the argument has long been clear, the paper's findings make an economic case for the merits of quicker action that allows for more direct comparison with some of the economic costs that have driven political debate around stay-at-home orders. And the paper's focus on rain-induced social distancing also provides a unique opportunity to isolate the impacts of social distancing from other related variables. Chenoy explained that many of the communities in the U.S. that were quickest to implement stay-at-home orders shared common demographic characteristics or similarities in political climate and public health resources. Those factors could impact pandemic outcomes independently, which makes it difficult to hone in on the specific effect of social distancing alone. But rainy weather provided an outside influence that compelled people to stay home across a relatively random sample of different types of communities. It doesn't rain more on a county because it has better hospitals, and the rain doesn't care whether you're rich or poor. It just sort of happens randomly, at least after you control for historical weather patterns. So nature handed us a scenario that was pretty well able to simulate a randomized experiment on the impacts of social distancing. Chenoy says another benefit of natural experiments is that they can prove useful for ground-truthing the predictions of epidemiological models. Ultimately, he hopes the current paper's findings may help to inform public health policy. An analysis within the paper suggests that earlier social distancing at the outset of the pandemic produced economic benefits on average primarily because it lowers the chance of very serious outbreaks in a small number of communities. Chenoy says this illustrates a major political challenge for stay-at-home orders. It's hard for leaders in a county to point to a concrete benefit of their policies because what they've averted is a small chance of a very bad outcome, he said. The county next door may get lucky and avoid that outcome too, even if they didn't lock down earlier. So you really need to have a very large comparison group to be able to actually detect these types of benefits. The research team believes their findings may offer a form of large-scale validation for the economic merits of quicker social distancing implementation. In fact, the authors argue that the paper's projected benefits are likely to underestimate since they focus only on the economic values of lives saved rather than other potential benefits like reduced healthcare costs and reduced incidence of chronic illness. Future research could sharpen the picture by incorporating these additional types of benefits and comparing them alongside other potential costs, like lost business profit, lost schooling time for children, or mental health impacts. More work will also be needed to assess how vaccines, treatments, and more infectious variants may have affected cost-benefit calculations since the first wave of the pandemic. Still, Chenoy points out that a significant mechanism affecting these calculations is that the costs of earlier social distancing are generally relatively fixed, while the benefits are more likely to continue accruing over time. He hopes that greater understanding of these economic payoffs could bring new perspective to discussions around public health policies. In our analysis, the economic benefits overall are really quite large relative to costs, and the reason for that is somewhat intuitive, he said. When it comes to slowing the spread of something like the coronavirus, taking steps early to cut off a transmission chain is an investment in public health that's going to pay exponential returns. Hear, hear. And in the confirmation of another major COVID-19 mitigation strategy, mask wearing, this from Science Daily. New study associates mask laws to reduction of COVID-19 deaths. A study of the impact of national face mask laws on COVID-19 mortality in 44 countries with a combined population of nearly 1 billion people found that over time, the increase in COVID-19 related deaths was significantly slower in countries that imposed mask laws compared to countries that did not. The study, appearing in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, shows that masks provide a supplementary layer of protection that could prevent unnecessary COVID-19 deaths. The average COVID-19 mortality per million population was 48 in countries with face mask policies and 289 in countries without face mask policies. Face mask countries had significantly lower average daily increase in deaths compared to no face mask countries. Surprisingly, the countries with no mask mandate started with a lower COVID-19 daily mortality. However, the death rate accelerated so fast in those countries that they not only caught up with the death rate in mask law countries, but significantly surpassed them over time. What do you know, folks? Public health works. Okay, well, can you carry that too far? Let's look to China, the king of the lockdown. This from Medical Express. China locks down city as COVID cases surge around the world. China shut down a city of 13 million people last Thursday in a bid to extinguish a tiny COVID-19 outbreak and chase its zero-case goal, as other nations around the globe battled huge infection surges driven by the Omicron variant. China locked down the northern city of Xi'an, most of the home of the world-famous Terracotta Warriors, to stamp out a cluster of several hundred cases. Omicron had not been reported in Xi'an, with only dozens of cases of the less infectious Delta variant detected in the city of 13 million people in recent days. But the Chinese government, in pursuit of its zero-case strategy ahead of the Beijing Winter Olympics, has reacted with typical forcefulness and ordered all Xi'an residents to stay indoors. Only one person per household can go outside every 2 days to buy necessities, while non-essential businesses are closed. February's Olympics are set to be the most restrictive mass sporting event since the pandemic began, with international spectators banned and all participants required to stay inside a closed-loop system. In addition to mandatory vaccinations before landing in China, all athletes and personnel inside the bubble must undergo daily testing. Those who test positive will not be able to participate, officials have said. Okay, well, there's more than one way to lock down or shut down, and the West likes unofficial lockdowns, not official lockdowns. This from Medical Express. Omicron is latest blow to pandemic-weary frontline workers. Staff absences for COVID-19 tripled this month in London's hospitals, and nearly 10% of the city's fire workers called out sick. In New York, about 2,700 police officers were absent earlier this week, twice the number who are ill on an average day. And on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, grocery worker Judy Snarsky says she's stretched to her limit, working 50 hours a week and doing extra tasks because her supermarket has around 100 workers when it should have closer to 150. The worldwide surge in coronavirus cases driven by the new Omicron variant is the latest blow to hospitals, police departments, supermarkets, and other critical operations struggling to maintain a full contingent of frontline workers as the pandemic enters its third year. Governments have taken steps to stem the bleeding across a range of jobs considered essential for society, from truckers and janitors to childcare providers and train conductors. But nurses and other workers worry that continued staffing woes will put the public at greater risk and increase burnout and fatigue among their ranks. Unions representing healthcare workers gripe that far too many hospitals failed to fill staff vacancies or to retain pandemic-weary staff. For example, there are 1,500 nursing vacancies in New York's three largest hospitals alone, or about double the number at the onset of the pandemic, said Carl Ginsberg, a spokesman for the 42,000-member New York State Nurses Association. The operators of U.S. nursing homes, which were crippled by some of the deadliest COVID-19 outbreaks early in the pandemic, are among those pleading for officials to do more. While cases in long-term care facilities have not risen sharply yet, the industry is bracing for Omicron, with 15% fewer workers today than when the pandemic began, said Rachel Reeves, a spokesperson for the American Healthcare Association and the National Center for Assisted Living, an industry trade group. Caregivers are burned out, Reeves said. Not only have many experienced tremendous loss, it has been exhausting, physically and emotionally, battling the virus day in and day out. But it's not just healthcare systems warning of dire consequences and seeking more support. Ed Bastian, CEO of Delta Airlines, was among those who have called on the Biden administration to cut recommended COVID-19 quarantine times down to 5 days or risk further disruptions in air travel. Delta, United, and Lufthansa have canceled dozens of flights over the Christmas period as illnesses take a toll on flight crews. Actually, that's thousands over the last several days. I have to update that one. Train operators also warn of sudden cancellations and other service shortages as subways and commuter lines endure COVID-19-related staff shortages. Even small businesses such as restaurants and nail salons, which are not necessarily considered essential, are preparing to further curtail hours or briefly shut down if worker shortages worsen. Okay, well, amidst all this, it's good to remember that one of the main reasons why we go through all these COVID-19 mitigation efforts is not necessarily to protect ourselves if we must be low to moderate risk, and if we're freedom-loving people who don't mind taking health risks. The thing is, with an infectious disease pandemic, what goes around comes around. And there are a lot of vulnerable people, particularly with this Omicron that's busting through full vaccination, and it's hard to surround people with protection by vaccination if it can break through full vaccination. So here is a groundbreaking study from Medical Express. Study of fully vaccinated patients with cancer who had breakthrough COVID-19 shows 13% mortality rate. The first study to evaluate the clinical characteristics and outcomes of fully vaccinated patients with cancer who had breakthrough COVID-19 infections indicates they remain at high risk for hospitalization and death. The studies published in the Annals of Oncology showed that fully vaccinated patients who experienced breakthrough infections had a hospitalization rate of 65%, an ICU or mechanical ventilation rate of 19%, and a 13% death rate. The study was conducted by the COVID-19 and Cancer Consortium, a group of 129 research centers that has been tracking the impact of COVID-19 on patients with cancer since the beginning of the pandemic. Similar results, that is, high mortality rates among fully vaccinated individuals, have been reported in other immunocompromised patient populations, such as organ transplant recipients, prior to the utilization of additional vaccine doses. These findings come at a time of concerns that immune escape mutants such as the Omicron strain may emerge from chronically infected patients with weakened immune systems. Thus, the immunosuppressed and their close contacts should be target groups for therapeutic and preventative interventions, including community-level outreach and educational efforts, said Dimitrios Pharmakiotis, an infectious disease clinician at the Medical School of Brown University and senior author of the study. Let us protect one another. Okay, last up in the COVID-19 news, this from Medical Express. First peer-reviewed study on excess mortality in India during the COVID-19 pandemic is published. Deaths during the COVID period exceeded those of years prior at a rate of 5.2 deaths per 1,000 residents. This represents a 41% increase over typical mortality level in the city. So that's very significant. And of course, a great underreporting from what the official statistics are in India. And this, of course, is true even in developed countries like the United States, maybe not to the same extent, but there's substantial underreporting for a variety of reasons around the world. Okay, well, now it's time for the local Lucas County COVID-19 update. And I want to do just a little bit of perspective and background. European countries with about one-fifth the population of the United States are crashing through 100,000 cases per day. So this would be something in the order of 500,000 cases per day in the U.S. if we had the same rate here. And here happens to be Ohio. Last week, Ohio set its new daily record of cases at almost 16,000. Ohio just happens to be about one-sixth of the population of these European countries, hitting 100,000 a day. So six times 16,000 would be 100,000. So rate-wise, Ohio, the state of Ohio, is on a similar par as these European countries that are crashing through 100,000 cases per day and setting new records. But of course, European countries seem to take the lead and show what's coming down the pike in a matter of weeks in the U.S. But getting a little closer to home, Cuyahoga County, good old Cleveland, their cases, their seven-day average has tripled in less than 2 weeks, and their total daily cases is about triple the previous peak of cases last winter, and it's still going up. Okay, but in Lucas County, it seems like, relatively speaking, we're holding our own. Does that make us at the head of the curve or behind the curve? I'm not really sure, but it's better news than worse, I suppose. Our total number of our average daily number of cases did bump up to 275 a day from 225 last week. But I just want to say that we have to shift from looking at case numbers and start looking at hospitalizations and eventually deaths, although it's a little early for Omicron to get a good bead on that. Partly because testing is going to be so cramped up. We're not really doing any more testing. So we're just going to max out an amount of testing that's available. So you can't get positive tests if people can't get tests. So it becomes less and less of an accurate indicator of the actual number of infections. And even over the course of the epidemic, only about 40% of infections are estimated to actually be identified by a test. It'll be worse now. Okay. The testing positivity rate for Ohio has skyrocketed. It's 24.2% as of today, Monday. That was 17.4% last week. Now, the volume of testing we're doing is actually slightly less than what we did in our peak in September during the Delta wave. So our testing has not really been ramped up that much. And it looks like we're doing so much home testing that, okay, this 24.2% is actually going to be the PCR tests, which are confirmatory tests. So a bunch of people are getting these sort of offline, off-the-grid home tests. And then if they get a positive or a suspected positive, they go get a PCR test to confirm it. So 24.2%, almost a quarter of the PCR tests in Ohio that are being used are showing a positive. That's getting into Crazyville. And the U.S., of course, went up, not quite as much as Ohio, but now the positivity rate in the entire country is 9.6%. up from 8.2% the week earlier. Okay, well, nursing home deaths, that's kind of a sentinel, the canary in the coal mine for problems in the community, and it looks like we're holding our own at least. We actually had a decrease in cases from 107 to 57. That's because we had a massive outbreak among staff last week. And we do have more residents that are infected this week, we had 30 residents and 27 staff. And the good news is we didn't have any more deaths reported from long-term care facilities in Lucas County. Good news. Okay, well, in Lucas County schools, things are holding about steady. We had a slight increase in the number of staff with identified infections from 44 to 47, and a decrease from 234 to 196 for students. But we had a different story statewide, is the number of staff infected statewide jumped almost 50% from 1,262 staff to 1,820, and the number of students made a nice little bump up too from 6,500 to about 7,900 students with identified infections. Okay, well, hospitalizations are edging up in Lucas County in Ohio after having leveled off in the last week or so. And after getting through the holiday season, we'll get a better read on that. If you look at like Cleveland, where it's raging off, it's actually going up faster. So clearly we're going to see increased hospitalizations. The question is how much? Deaths nationally are cruising at over 1,500 deaths per day on average. And the death rate in Ohio is as high as it's ever been, still averaging about 100 COVID-19 deaths per day. Now, a weird way to look at this as far as hospitalizations, we're just under 5,000 people in a hospital in Ohio right now. But if 100 of those are dying each day, that means you're having a 2% daily drop in hospitalization simply by, quote, checking out of the hospital and checking in to the morgue. Okay, well, vaccinations, it seems that being boosted is the new standard, so I'm adding that to my regular reporting. So, in the U.S. as a whole, of those that are fully vaccinated with the two doses, we have 61.7% of the entire population, and 31.5% of those people that are fully vaccinated have received their booster yet, so just under a third of the people nationwide that were fully vaccinated have received a booster. That means of the entire U.S. population, just under 20%, 19.4% of the total U.S. population has been boosted. Way to go. Now, the state and the county here, Lucas County, have trailed in vaccinations definitely, but we do seem to be doing a better job on boosting than the nation as a whole. So we're still lagging from the nationwide fully vaccinated rate of 61.7 at 54.7 in the state and a little less, 53.3% in the county. But of those people that were fully vaccinated in the state, 38.5% of them are received their booster shot. And in the county, 40% of those who were fully vaccinated have received the booster. So that's just over 21% of the entire Ohio or county population that is boosted, fully ready, raring to go, which has beat out the nation at 19.4%. Way to go, Ohio and Lucas County. Okay, well, I haven't reported on the racial ethnic disparity in vaccination because it kind of peaked out in the county at about, blacks are about two-thirds as likely to be fully vaccinated as whites, and about three-quarters as likely to be fully vaccinated as whites in the state. So Lucas County has done worse, and this has been very consistent for months and months, this whole year pretty much, since we really reached fully vaccinated folks. It increased somewhat over time, but that disparity between the county and the state has remained. Now, when you look at booster shots, Lucas County blacks are 29% as likely to be boosted as whites. Yikes. Compared to the state where blacks are 75% as likely to be boosted as whites who were fully vaccinated previously. So there's something going on that while we have a pretty good boosting campaign, we are not boosting people equitably, racial, ethnic wise. So we have a ways to go and a clarion call to reach out to racial ethnic minority communities to get boosted as well. Okay, well, you are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM, We Act Radio in Toledo. This is Just for the Health of It. We are the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Well, folks, public health is a long game, and you have to look to our infrastructure to see how things are going to fare in the future. We've got a bead on that from Medical Express here. The U.S. doesn't have enough faculty to train the next generation of nurses. Despite a national nursing shortage in the United States, over 80,000 qualified applicants were not accepted at U.S. nursing schools in 2020, according to the American Association of Colleges of Nursing. This was due primarily to a shortage of nursing professors and a limited number of clinical placements where nursing students get practical job training. Additional constraints include a shortage of experienced practitioners to provide supervision during clinical training, insufficient classroom space, and inadequate financial resources. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates there will be about 194,500 openings for registered nurses each year over the next decade to meet the demands of the growing population and also to replace nurses who retire or quit the profession. This means the U.S. will need about 2 million new registered nurses by 2030. Okay, well, next up, I got a piece that's a little bit of a follow-up to a story I did last week, which talked about that as far as like cognitive decline or Alzheimer's, the benefit that you get from high levels of formal education is not as much now as it was in previous generations. But there are a lot more formally educated people now than there were in previous generations. So you got two different dynamics go there. And the last week's story, unfortunately, that was bad news, that it seems that that effect has been diminished. But the good news is that we have a lot more people that are educated, and particularly for women, it seems to make a difference. So this from Medical Express. Serious cognitive impairment declines 23% among older American women over a decade. A new nationally representative study published online in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease found an abrupt decline in the prevalence of cognitive impairment among Americans adults aged 65 and older compared to the same age group a decade earlier. In 2008, 12.2% of older Americans reported serious cognitive problems. In 2017, the percentage had declined to 10.0%. To put this into perspective, if the prevalence of cognitive impairment had remained at the 2008 levels, an additional 1.13 million older Americans would have experienced cognitive impairment in 2017. The study was based on 10 consecutive waves of the American Community Survey from 2008 to 2017, an annual nationally representative cross-sectional survey of approximately 500,000 American respondents aged 65 and older, including both institutionalized and community-dwelling older adults. A total of 5.4 million older Americans were included in the study. In each year, respondents were asked to report if they had, quote, serious difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions. Further analysis indicated that 60% of the observed decline in serious cognitive impairment between 2008 and 2017 was attributable to generational differences in educational attainment. Extensive previous research has concluded that every additional year of formal schooling lowers the risk of individuals eventually developing dementia. Compared to children born in the 1920s, Americans born in each successive decade had much greater opportunities to pursue post-secondary education. It appears that these increasing educational opportunities continue to pay dividends more than a half a century later, said co-author Catherine Allen, a recent Master of Social Work graduate from the University of Toronto School of Social Work. The short-term benefits of increasing educational attainment for income, productivity, and economy are well documented, but our research suggests the long-term benefits on later life cognitive functioning are substantial. Our findings underline the importance of ensuring each generation has access to quality and affordable education. However, the decline in the prevalence of cognitive problems was not entirely explained by generational differences in educational attainment, suggesting there may be other factors at play that warrant further research. The authors hypothesize several possible contributors to these positive trends, such as improvement across the generations in nutrition, declines in smoking and air pollution, and the phase out of leaded gasoline. Our findings from the study of over 5 million older adults is definitely a very welcome, good news story, indicating a steep decline in the prevalence of cognitive impairment among older adults. We still need to investigate whether these positive trends will continue in the decades ahead and why men's rates of improvement are lagging behind those of women.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, of course, much public health news tends to be of the worst nature rather than the better. This one fits into that category from Medical Express. New poll, major spike among American adults skipping medical treatment due to cost. Nearly one-third, or 30% of Americans, skipped medical, needed medical care in the past 3 months due to cost, the highest reported number since the COVID-19 pandemic began, and a threefold increase from March to October, according to the latest survey from the nonprofit, nonpartisan organization West Health and Gallup, the global analytics and advice firm. Even about 20% of the nation's highest income households, those earning more than $120,000 per year, blame cost as a reason for not seeking care, up from 3% over the same time frame. The survey, the largest conducted on healthcare since the pandemic began, also found that the COVID-19 experience has significantly shaped public opinion of the U.S. healthcare system, which an estimated 100 million Americans would self-describe as either expensive or broken. Nearly half, 40% of Americans, say their view of healthcare in America has decidedly worsened due to the pandemic. An estimated 150 million Americans, 59%, say they are now more worried about the cost of healthcare services, and 45% are more worried about the cost of prescription drugs. It is no wonder more than half the country reports that the high cost of healthcare contributes some, 36%, or a lot, 15%, of stress to their daily lives. Another 60% report higher concern over growing healthcare inequities, a concern that rises to nearly 75% of Black Americans and more than two-thirds of Hispanic Americans. An estimated 12.7 million people, or 1 in 20 American adults, report that a friend or family member died this year after not receiving treatment because they could not afford it, with Black Americans twice as likely to know someone who died as white Americans. Americans have reached their breaking point, said Shelley Lyford, president and CEO of West Health, dedicated to lowering healthcare costs to enable successful aging. Between March and October, the percentage of people reporting trouble paying for healthcare, skipping treatment, and not filling their prescriptions spiked to the highest level since the pandemic began, exacerbating another public health threat born out of cost rather than illness. Despite attempts in Washington to address high healthcare prices through Build Back Better legislation, more than two-thirds of Americans, regardless of party affiliation, are pessimistic that policies that reduce costs will emerge. In fact, 9 in 10 expect their costs to continue to rise, and 42% are concerned they will be unable to pay for healthcare services in the coming year. This negative public sentiment did not form overnight or begin with COVID-19. It's been decades in the making after failed promises by elected officials to do something to help Americans suffering at the hand of high prices for healthcare and prescription drugs, said Tim Lash, Chief Strategy Officer for West Health. However, public opinion plays an important role in the policy process, and if policymakers are listening, they have no choice but to act. National health spending is nearly $4 trillion in this country, approximately 20% of gross domestic product, making it the most expensive healthcare system in the world. Well, folks, one more really good reason to advocate for healthcare for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, more on growing national healthcare spending. This from Medical Express. U.S. national healthcare spending increased 9.7% in 2020. The researchers found a 9.7% increase in U.S. healthcare spending in 2020 to reach $4.1 trillion. This rate was much higher than a 4.3% increase in 2019. The accelerated rate for 2020 was due to a 36% increase in federal expenditures for healthcare, which were mainly in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. At the same time, there was a 2% decrease in the gross domestic product. The share of the economy devoted to healthcare spending spiked, peaking at 19.7%. There was a decrease in the number of uninsured people in 2020, while significant shifts in the type of coverage were seen. Yep, folks, while more people are covered, we're seeing actually growing number of people that are poorly insured or underinsured. Okay, well, while 2021 is coming to an end, the American Heart Association, the largest non-governmental funder of heart and stroke-related research in the United States, has been compiling an annual list of major advances in heart disease and stroke science in 1996. This from the American Heart Association. Three of those top stories in 2021 I'm going to highlight. First up, there's new hope in the fight against the obesity epidemic. Some 650 million people worldwide have obesity, a major risk factor for cardiovascular disease, and the problem continues to grow. In June 2021, semaglutide, as a weekly under-the-skin injection, became the first medicine since 2014 to be approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration for chronic weight management. Participants who were treated with the drug were likely to lose significantly more weight, up to as much as 16% of their body weight, compared to as little as 2.4% of body weight loss among those given a placebo. In a different approach to obesity, another new study found that people with obesity who underwent bariatric surgery had a 42% lower risk of dying or having major cardiovascular problems such as heart attack, stroke, and heart failure hospitalization, compared to matched peers who did not have the surgery. Second up, lifestyle and clinical interventions are key tools to tackling hypertension. Nearly half of the U.S. population has hypertension, or high blood pressure, one of the leading contributors to heart attacks and strokes. The massive salt substitute and stroke study from China involving 600 rural villages and nearly 21,000 people found that replacing 25% of the sodium chloride in the salt shaker with potassium chloride could reap major health improvements, including a 14% reduction in stroke rates. Another large trial from China reported the potential benefits of tighter blood pressure control among study participants who were assigned to an intensive intervention targeted to lower their blood pressure. And thirdly, highlighting, flu vaccine may also protect the heart. While flu vaccines are highly recommended for people with cardiovascular disease who are at high risk from the flu, a new study found the vaccine may offer extended protection beyond flu season. Researchers found that people vaccinated against the flu within 72 hours of a heart attack or invasive coronary procedure were 28% less likely to have a heart attack or a dangerous clot in a coronary stent or die of any cause over the course of the next year, compared to people who received a placebo vaccine. Those who received the flu vaccine were also 41% less likely to die of cardiovascular disease. So what do you know? The unending benefits of vaccines. Go vaccines. Okay, next up, a nutrition study or report here from Food Politics, where the author says, my latest paper, portion size. My former doctoral student, now colleague Lisa Young, has been tracking the increase in portion sizes of junk foods for more than 30 years. Our latest report has just come out in the American Journal of Public Health. Portion size of ultra-processed foods in the United States from 2002 to 2021. At first introduction, most companies offered products in just one size. That size is smaller than or equal to the smallest size currently available. For example, the original size of a Coca-Cola bottle was 6.5 ounces. Today it comes in 6 sizes, marketed as single servings. These range from 7.5 ounces to 24 ounces, 4 of which have been introduced since 2002. Since 2002, McDonald's has reduced the size of its French fries and eliminated its supersize French fries and soda, but still offers quart-size sodas and double burgers. While McDonald's and Burger King decreased the size of their largest portion of French fries, they increased the size of their smallest portions. While Burger King reduced the size of its hamburger sandwiches since 2002, they added a triple Whopper. As we have pointed out previously, portion sizes increased in parallel with the rising prevalence of obesity. Larger portions are a problem for 3 reasons. 1. They have more calories. If only this were intuitively obvious, but it is not. 2. They encourage people to eat more. 3. They confuse people about how much they are eating. Our recommendations? We think it is time to also consider caps and other legislatively mandated national policy options to require the food industry to make smaller food portions more available, convenient, and inexpensive. We could offer consumers price incentives for smaller portions of ultra-processed foods. Discontinue the largest sizes of ultra-processed packaged foods and fast food portions, and restrict marketing of large portions of ultra-processed foods, especially those targeted children and minorities. Our article is accompanied by an editorial by Carlos Monteiro and Jeffrey Cannon, the inventors of the term ultra-processed. Yes, food portion sizes and people have become bigger and bigger. What is to be done? Their point? Reducing portion sizes is unlikely to work internationally. In such countries, reduced portion size of ultra-processed foods would at best have limited effect and most likely would be counterproductive if they marketed to promote their consumption. Generally, the most rational guideline for global as well as personal health and well-being is to protect and promote minimally processed foods and freshly prepared meals and to discourage the consumption of ultra-processed foods altogether, together with statutory measures including fiscal policies and actions. These measures should make fresh and minimally processed foods cheaper and more available. Ultra-processed foods should be made more expensive and less available, if at all, especially in canteens and hospitals, other health settings, and in or near schools. Cosmetic additives should be banned or highly taxed. We have much work to do. Okay, well, I want to close with a good news story. This is one about arts in the public health. This from Medical Express. Hip-hop song linked to a reduction in suicides in the U.S. Wide-scale public attention to the song 1-800-273-8255 by American hip-hop artist Logic was associated with an increase in calls to the U.S. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline and a reduction in suicides, finds a study in the Christmas issue of the British Medical Journal. The findings demonstrate the protective effect of positive media stories about suicidal thoughts and help-seeking behavior, particularly for groups that are hard to reach with traditional messaging, says researchers. There's clear evidence that media reports of suicide can trigger further suicides, but less is known about the protective effects of reports of hope and recovery, mainly because they receive much less media coverage than stories of suicide death. One exception was in April 2017, when the American hip-hop artist Logic released the song 1-800-273-8255, prominently featuring the number of the U.S. National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The song describes someone in suicidal crisis who calls the number for help, which marks a turning point towards improvement and mastery of their crisis. The song reached number 3 on the U.S. Billboard charts and was performed at the 2017 MTV Music Awards and the 2018 Grammy Awards, generating intense public attention. To assess whether the song's positive message was linked to a change in behavior, researchers at the Medical University of Vienna examined association between Logic's song and daily calls to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, as well as daily suicides in the U.S. Using Twitter posts to estimate audience attention over 1 month, they found that in the 34-day period immediately after the 3 events with the strongest public attention, the song's release, the MTV Video Music Awards, and the Grammy Awards, there were an extra 9,915 calls to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, an increase of 6.9% over the expected number. Over the same period, there was a reduction of 245 suicides, or 5.5% below the expected number. As such, They say these findings emphasize the potential population health benefits of working creatively and innovatively with other sectors, such as the music and entertainment industries, to promote new, impactful stories of help-seeking that resonate with broad audiences, leaving a visible footprint on social media, and are safe in terms of not featuring potentially lethal actions, but rather coping and mastery of crisis. Interventions that follow these principles could help create behavioral changes to increase help-seeking and prevent suicide. The study further supports the Papageno effect, the theory that media reports of an individual overcoming a suicidal crisis are protective against suicide, writes Alexandra Pittman of University College London in a linked editorial. She says further work is needed to help us understand the intervention's likely mechanisms of action, but until then, she welcomes the commitment of key cultural influencers to help amplify public health interventions intended to strengthen protection against suicide in specific vulnerable groups. All right. Hip-hop is public health, too, or at least it can be. Okay, well, I have some bonus articles you can read online. I'll give you the link after I list these seven articles. First up, I worked in a locked psychiatric ward. These days, you do, too. Paralleling the COVID-19 pandemic with a locked psychiatric ward. A very interesting read. Second, for a deep dive into Omicron, a computational biologist weighs in on Omicron, the future of vaccines, and the CDC's variant forecast. Number three, invisible virus protection for indoor spaces. This is a good story on a technology that's developed. It uses UV light, a thin wall of light that actually is turned off by a motion sensor so it doesn't actually hit human beings because UV light can have negative problems as well. And then, you know, air that's blown around. Very cool technological advantage that may be the wave of the future for preventing respiratory infectious diseases. Okay, fourth article. Claims of vaccine hesitancy in African countries are at odds with the reality on the ground. Another victim-blaming situation. Five, EPA official prevented staff from warning public about widely used carcinogen. Six, why kids should not have a lot of toys and what to do if yours have too many. That seems timely after the biggest toy-giving season of the year. And seven, why emotional intelligence takes a dive among the affluent, and when economic inequality rises, concern for others dips. Yes, folks, we've known for a long time that being affluent makes you an a-hole. You can read these and other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-